we're listening to Liliana Herrero. And we heard from Liliana Felipe before that with the tune called Buscarte. We heard from Daca Braca. Joy and Drolma started us out on her last portion of Radio Free Chico. And that about does it for us today. And I'll see you again next week. Stay tuned moments away. From Peace and Social Justice. I'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye. I'm not getting anything on. I can't even hear what's going on in the.
I can't hear anything.
There we go. Okay. Not hearing anything on my headphones. That's weird, but. Let's get the speaker on, and I'll listen to myself over the speaker.
Crap.
All right. Let's try that. There we go. Hey. Welcome to Peace and Justice. This is FM 90.1, KZFR, Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. I'm your host, Jesse Kearns, and I want to welcome you to Peace and Justice here on Friday, July 21st. I'm your Friday host, Jesse Kearns, and today we present the Awesome Authors edition of the show. And I've got three authors who have written books that address ways in which faith intersects with culture, both in the realm of peace and justice and in government. Somebody told me not long ago that a lot of my guests seem like they come out of the same cookie cutter. So if you're looking for more variety in the cookie jar, we got it today. So with that, let me remind you that the views and opinions of the hosts and guests on this show do not reflect the views and opinions of KZFR, its staff, its board of directors, its underwriters, and its volunteers. Each of the hosts of Peace and Justice bring different gifts, graces, and specialties to the table, and mine has to do with how public affairs intersect with matters of faith. A large majority of the population claim to see the world through the lens of faith. That doesn't mean they're part of any organized religious group, but I think they still claim some sort of faith. And to be honest, I don't think we really talk all that much about that in the public arena. So when we do, it's not always in a positive or helpful way. So I'm not here to preach. I'm not here to tell you how to think or how to believe. I'm just here to educate, enlighten, and hopefully inspire. And if we throw in a little music for the fun of it, you've got peace and social justice here on KZFR. So what I'm going to do right now is I am going to try to get our first guest on the phone again. So since it's our Awesome Authors edition, let's hear some music about being an author.
Paperback writer.
Alrighty, that is the Beatles and Paperback Writer. And again, this is our awesome authors edition of Peace and Justice. And I have today, hopefully, Richard Dolezal. You there with me?
Yes, I am, Jesse.
Oh, you have no idea how glad I am to hear your voice.
Well, I'm happy to be invited to Chico.
Yeah, well, it's kind of warm here today, but I don't think that has anything, you know, surprising for you, because you're in Arizona, and we don't even know what warm is it?
Yes.
So, Richard is the author of The Fourth Wall, a book that some have described as a Dan Brown-esque thriller. So, you know, being compared to the author of The Da Vinci Code. So, but back in June, one of our hosts, Chris Nelson, received an invitation from Richard's publicist to have him on the show.
And the email said, with the New York Times reporting on the influence of organized religion on American politics, and more specifically, the party affiliations of religious leaders of different religions and denominations, religion and politics are becoming more and more intertwined in the national conversation. Is this a good thing? Lawyer and author Richard T. Dolezal can offer commentary on the current climate of political discussions among religious conservatives. And Chris Nelson forwarded that to me and said, you know, this sounds like it's up your alley, Jesse. And I said, I will take it. So, Richard, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you again.
Hey, tell me a little bit about yourself and what inspired you to write this book.
Well, my background is I'm a lawyer, and I was part of the Justice Department for a period of time. And during the time I was a practicing lawyer, I noticed how the ACLU was picking off soft targets with respect to symbols in the public square, like the menorah, cross, Ten Commandments, nativity scenes, etc. And that happened for years. And I kept thinking, well, why haven't, you know, Christians or Jews, Judeo-Christian entities, pushed back? And so I thought, well, that might be, you know, a novel. And that's how I got inspired to do this.
Okay. So there's been a lot of discussion and debate in the news lately about the intersection of religion and politics. You know, on one side, you've got evangelical churches endorsing and supporting conservative policies and politicians, you know, whether these politicians are religious or not. And then on the other side, you're seeing an increasing number of mainline churches starting to show support for more liberal policymakers who appear to defend their causes. Do you think religion and politics are a dangerous mix?
I think they're, I guess you would say they're certainly a dangerous mix if you look at the Middle East or Pakistan and India. In the United States, I don't think they're a particularly dangerous mix. I think it's just the nature of the two entities of church and state coexisting. And, you know, you had mentioned an intersection of politics and religion. I tend to think that maybe politics and religion are on the same road, going in the same direction, and they have been for decades and centuries. It's just that now the bigger vehicle on the road is the state, and they trump the state trumps politics based on what the Supreme Court says with respect to freedom of expression of religion.
Okay. So let's talk about some of how our founding fathers saw what they intended for our country. You know, some will argue that our founders never intended our country to be a Christian nation, and that the ideal was to build a nation where religious diversity is celebrated. And yet, there are those who would take the other side of that argument and say that we were founded on Christian principles and that our current leaders should try to promote Christian values above others. And then there's a big segment of our population that say we should just keep religion out of public policy altogether. What is your understanding of the role of religion in government and I guess government and religion?
You know, it's a good question, Justin. I think, you know, the founding fathers, you know, based on everything that I've read, and certainly it's in the Constitution, and you can torture the language of the Constitution as you will, but it seems to me that the reason why they came over to this continent was to be able to freely express themselves in their own religion and not be dictated to by a government or be persecuted by a larger religious entity. And so I think I don't necessarily believe that we were a Christian nation. I think we were founded on Christian principles, but I think that the reality of it is that we're a nation where people should be free to practice whatever religion they choose to practice.
Right. Right. Well, you are listening to Peace and Social Justice on KZFR. This is FM 90.1, and Peace and Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Hall Marketing and Design. Owner Charlotte Hall and her team can get your business the attention it desires through creative marketing, design, and branding. They are specialists in creating brochures, websites, ads, and promotional materials. So whether you're a new business or a business looking for a new look, Hall Marketing and Design can create an image that fits your style. For a free consultation, call 895-9484 or visit hallmarketingdesign.com. And by the Zeppelin Works, specializing in Volkswagen, BMW, Porsche, Audi, Volvo, and Mercedes since 1981. The Zeppelin Works is a full-service repair facility providing technical expertise for any European automotive problem or maintenance. More information can be found by calling 893-0757 or zeppelinworks.com. And if you're just joining us, this is Peace and Justice on KZFR 90.1. And we're talking today to Richard Dolezal, the author of The Fourth Wall. So, you know, you've been compared to Dan Brown in your writing style. As I was reading the reviews of the book and such like that, I hear there's a nuke going off in that book there. And, you know, you always got to be a sucker for a book that has a big explosion like that. But what prompted you to choose the medium of fiction to get your message across?
Well, first of all, I would love to have Dan Brown's book sales.
You really?
Somebody else has compared me to Dan Brown. I would never do that. But I wanted to write a murder mystery, and that's what this book is. It's a murder mystery, and the reason why I chose fiction is that I had an opportunity to do a lot of things that probably I would be more limited if I used nonfiction.
Right.
And but the triggering event of the murder mystery is the fact that the Pope, and I use the Pope as a proxy for all Christian leaders, but the Pope receives irrefutable proof that for decades the ACLU has been systematically destroying Christianity in America, and he decides to push back. And so where the murder mystery comes in is that he hires a famed trial lawyer from Washington, D.C. to confront the ACLU, and they have him killed. And that's the start of the book.
Okay. So I gather then that you aren't a huge fan of the ACLU.
No. I think the ACLU serves a purpose.
Okay.
And they've done a great job of promoting themselves. I mean, if you read the history of the ACLU, you would say, wow, they're probably pretty irreligious, and they're communists, fascists, anarchists. They had the good fortune of getting a lot of great press during the Vietnam War, and so they put together a tremendous marketing campaign, and now they're very popular. I think they do some good things, but now they've started to become political, I think, more than they've ever been before.
Okay. How do you see this? I mean, what examples can you think of?
With respect to political?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they recently started a campaign to, you know, obviously Trump triggered a lot of this, but after Trump's election, for example, the donations to the ACLU just were voluminous, from Hollywood celebrities, from billionaires, from ordinary people who thought that Trump's immigration policies were crazy. And so the ACLU began a process of teaching people how to demonstrate protests, mm-hmm. You know, kind of like a Saul Alinsky kind of a thing. And so that seems to be outside of their charter, where their charter was really to protect people's civil liberties. Now they're kind of going out on the offensive.
Okay. Yeah, I know there's a lot of religious folks that say ACLU is the devil, but, you know, when you go back and look at the wonderful things that they've done, you know, helping end segregation in schools and a ton of other anti-discrimination cases involving women in workplace and all that,
yeah,
they even...
Right.
ended the anti-Oki laws here in California back in the 40s. But, you know, a lot of people might turn that around and say, well, you know, look at the church. The church has done some, you know, horrific things in the course of history, too. Salem witch trials, Inquisition, upholding slavery, using the Bible to support segregation. Wouldn't it be just better to acknowledge that all have sinned and try to find a better way to unite and live more peacefully with each other rather than, you know, cause further division?
Well, it's just like the bumper sticker coexist.
Yeah.
I mean, where has that ever worked? I mean, even among Christian denominations, I mean, they're competitive and they don't agree among themselves regarding maybe certain points of the Bible or Christianity or salvation. So it's really hard to pull everybody together and say, okay, let's get along. Obviously, that would be the goal. As long as human beings, as you said, are sinful, how's that going to work? How's that going to happen?
Mm-hmm. I've heard religious leaders on both the right and the left end of that political spectrum and even the social spectrum say that even though Jesus was a religious leader, he you know, much of his teaching challenged the secular leadership of the day, and you know, most churches who claim to be followers of Jesus say that it's their responsibility to challenge the powers and principalities of whatever political party happens to be in power at the time. So what are some ways that churches in America can push back against policies that seem to be antithetical to their understanding of Jesus' teaching?
You know, that's a great question, Jesse, and I wish I had a great response for you. But, I mean, when you have, Christian churches, some of whom have no problem with homosexuality, the LGBTQ community, others do. Others, you know, because of Eugene Robinson up in Hartford, Connecticut, caused a schism in his church, in his religious organization. It's really hard. And how can you come together and push back if you probably can't even agree on what the secular policies are that you want to attack and maybe legislate? So I think until we have religious leaders who can pull everybody together and march in one direction, I just think we're as soft targets as the municipalities the ACLU started to pick off.
I guess I'm a little bit more of an optimist on that one. But then again...
Well, I think that's great. But I think, Christians and others are intent on their salvation. That's probably a very important thing. They want to reach out to others and love others as Jesus commanded us to do. But how do you do that with a laboring oar that's rowing in the same direction?
Right. Okay. Richard, I always ask my guests before we close down an interview, what's a good word that you can offer us today? What is a good word of hope in your understanding of how we can achieve a better unity and more religious cooperation, whatever that might be?
I think patience, I guess, would be a word that pops into my mind because generationally, the people who maybe were more stringent in their belief systems will be on their way to heaven sooner than some of us, and that the new generations are more open-minded. And probably have more promise and more charity on a daily basis than the previous generations.
Yeah. All right. Well, where can folks find your book?
They can find my book on Amazon.com.
Okay.
And I also have a website, www.richarddolezal.com.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And actually, the title of the book, Jesse, is The Fourth Vow, and that has to do with a Jesuit, the vow that Tate has loyalty to the Pope. So it's kind of a Catholic thing, but as I said earlier, I use the Pope as a proxy for all Christian leaders.
Mm-hmm.
The government is monolithic, but I think Christian denominations are fragmented. And so they become, you know, united. They really probably don't stand a chance against the Supreme Court and the Congress.
Okay. Well, Richard, I appreciate you being on the program today. I appreciate you taking the time. Your book came out around the first of the year, was it?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. You got anything else cooking up in your head there?
Well, I have a number of books that I'm thinking about writing, and it's using some of the same characters. But I think I'm going to stay away from some of the hot points of Christianity and the ACLU. I like to sell more books. I want to sell my books to at least half the country, probably the red states, but I really didn't write it to be a conservative book. It would just be a murder mystery, but yeah. I'm kind of going down this path, and that's fine.
All right. Well, thank you, and I wish you the best, and KZFR expresses its appreciation to you for reaching out to us, too, or at least your publicist reaching out to us so that you can talk to us today.
Well, Jesse, I think the Chico community should be very happy to have you in its midst. So I was reading about your Interfaith Council and things and the good work that they do, and I think that's really wonderful.
Hey, well, thank you for looking that up. I think our Interfaith Council is pretty cool, too.
It sounds great. It's a wonderful community, and thank you for having me on your show.
All right. You take care, Richard.
Take care. Bye, Jesse.
Okay, and you are listening to KZFR FM 90.1, Chico, California, and we've got another song coming up here. What's horrible is the CD is in the CD player, and I'm not exactly sure which song is up next, so it'll be a surprise to all of us.
I wonder who wrote the book of love. Tell me, who wrote the book of love? I've got to know the answer. Was it someone from above? I wonder who wrote the book of love? Who wrote the book of love? Chapter 1 says the lover, you love her with all your heart. Chapter 2, you tell her, you never, 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 ever gonna part. In chapter 3, remember the meaning of romance. In chapter 4, you break up, but you give her just one more chance. Oh, I wonder who wrote the book of love? Yes, I do. Well, it says so in this book of love. Ours is the one that's true. I wonder who wrote the book of love. Chapter 1 says to love her, you love her with all your heart. Chapter 2, you tell her, you never, 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 ever gonna part. In chapter 3, remember the meaning of romance. In chapter 4, you break up, but you give her just one more chance. Oh, I wonder who wrote the book of love. Baby, I love you, yes I do. Well, it says so in this book of love. Ours is the one that's true.
Wonder who wrote the book of love.
And this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you are listening to Peace and Social Justice. I'm your host, Jesse Kearns, and today is our Awesome Authors edition. We've already talked to Richard Dolezal, and he was our person here live. Sorry about all the little technical glitches at the beginning there. But the next two interviews were pre-recorded because our authors could not be with us live. So our second segment here is Craig Watts, who is the author of Bowing to Babylon. So here is that interview. My next guest is Reverend Craig M. Watts, who is the senior minister of Royal Palm Christian Church in Coral Springs, Florida. I am most familiar with Reverend Watts' contributions to the Red Letter Christians Network and the Disciple Peace Fellowship Facebook page. And Craig is also the author of two books, Disciple of Peace, Alexander Campbell on Pacifism, Violence, and the State, and most recently, Bowing Towards Babylon, the Nationalistic Subversion of Christian Worship in America. Welcome to the awesome author's edition of Peace and Justice.
Good to be with you, Jesse.
As one of four hosts of the Peace and Justice program here in Chico, I like to focus on how faith intersects with culture. And I read an article by Jonathan Agner in Patheos recently called First Baptist Dallas Ignores Jesus, Worships America on Freedom Sunday. And immediately I thought about your book. And I imagine you see a lot of things like that. So I guess my first question to you is, what led you to write this book, Bowing Towards Babylon?
Actually, it was a long time coming. I've written quite a number of articles, both academic and shorter pieces, blog pieces, on this particular theme. It started in my first church 30-some years ago. I was fresh out of Vanderbilt Divinity School and ended up in a small town in Oklahoma. I was probably entirely misplaced to be there, but nevertheless, first year went wonderfully well. And I happened to be out of town for a meeting, and the worship committee met. And that year, the 4th of July, had the misfortune of falling on a Sunday.
Yeah.
And they decided to plan a service in my absence that they were just certain that I would be glad to participate in and lead. Unfortunately, they were wrong. They wanted the flag to be very prominent. They wanted a color guard, pledge allegiance, you know, the standard patriotic hymns and so forth. And there was no way I could lead that service. I simply thought it was inappropriate for who we are as Christians. And so I called the committee back together again and did my best to talk to them theologically and biblically about why I couldn't lead this service. And it didn't go so well.
Yes, Barbara. How did that go, Craig?
Well, some of the kinder people just thought that I must just be misunderstanding their intention. You know, this is just a way of being thankful for America. And then some thought that I was just a heretic, or one person accused me of being a Jehovah's Witness.
A Jehovah's Witness, wow.
Right? Yeah. And about a month later, there was a vote called to fire me. The vote did fail, just barely, but I knew that my ministry there was over.
Yeah.
But that certainly caused me to reflect a lot on what was going on there. What were the passions involved that would cause a people who are supposed to be devoted to Jesus above all, fire their minister who is seeking to be devoted to Jesus above all, over something that really has nothing to do with Jesus or with what is supposed to be our central convictions as people of faith?
Right.
And so the subsequent articles and then finally this book arose from that.
Yeah. I have to make a confession. I direct a summer camp, our Christian Youth Fellowship, our high school age camp, and it always falls on 4th of July week. And so the joke is there are a lot of clergy people up there who are counselors at that camp and keynoters and chaplains and things like that, and they were all sitting around the picnic table a couple of years joking about how we have no problems getting clergy to come and counsel at that camp because nobody ever wants to face the drama that they inevitably face when people want to sing patriotic hymns and wave the flags on 4th of July services.
Right, exactly. In the church that I'm serving right now, years ago, when I'd been here just a couple of years, one of the elders suggested that I should just take that Sunday off every year.
Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't going to happen.
That wasn't going to happen, huh? Well, I've got to confess that I'm on my, we have a 3-year cycle of directing here, and I'm off the cycle this year. So next year, I'm going to have to face the music, which I have before as a pastor. I've also got to confess that I'm one of these people who sometimes can be oblivious to sanctuary decor. And so there are times when I'll walk into a church and somebody will say, "Oh, yeah, you were at First Methodist or First Baptist or whatever like that. Did they have a flag in their sanctuary?" And I have to confess that I don't notice things like that. In fact, I could probably, and our church has a flag in it. It's kind of tucked away in the corner. And I have to confess that if somebody took that away and I walked into the sanctuary, I wouldn't notice it at all.
Right.
But I'll guarantee you there's a few people in the church who would notice it very soon.
Yeah.
When did this start happening? When in our history did this start becoming an issue?
Well, the flag idolatry that we have in this country certainly wasn't always in existence.
Right.
In fact, for probably the first, I'd say, 80 years of the country, the flag was not the most prominent patriotic symbol. In fact, the most prominent patriotic symbol was a picture of George Washington.
Oh.
Even during 4th of July services, or not services, but 4th of July community gatherings, often there wouldn't be a flag. There would always be a picture of George Washington.
Okay.
It wasn't until the Civil War that the flag started taking such prominence, and it was only at the Civil War that flags ever started appearing into the churches. A few at first, and then more and more. There was a concerted effort after the Civil War, when there was a strong emphasis on our identity as a united people, that the flag just became more and more and more central. And so there was a big effort at the end of the 19th century to have a different kind of programs, events, contests, and so forth, that would bring the flag into schools. It hadn't been in schools before that.
Mm-hmm.
Various into churches, into public buildings. Often, the flag wouldn't even be in government buildings.
Oh.
But after the Civil War, all that changed, and it really increased more and more as we got, especially like into the 1890s, when the Pledge of Allegiance was introduced. And that came out of, actually, there was some contests that were taking place to get the flag into public schools at that time.
And this was prior to the Under God addition to the Pledge of Allegiance,
right,
too.
Right, yeah, that didn't come until
50s? You
know, yeah. It was during Eisenhower.
Yeah. Okay. So as this has evolved, and I'm going back to this article that I read in Patheos, and it was talking about how overboard this church in Dallas went in their worship of the flag, to the point where the author didn't even think that Jesus was mentioned during the whole service. You know, it's hard for me to imagine a church service where Jesus is not mentioned, but, you know, if the author is perceiving this, something is terribly wrong. And I've often heard, you know, talking about how that kind of patriotism and nationalism that is shown during a worship service like that is actually idolatrous.
Yes, I believe it is idolatrous. Most churches don't go to that sort of extreme. I do have a member of my congregation. He was the president of the local veterans organization. Somebody invited him to a church several years ago, and it was the same sort of flamboyant, extreme patriotism. I was able to see a video of it. and they had a huge flag, you know, at the front of the sanctuary. They had not just the normal patriotic music, but they played patriotic music for each arm of the armed services, each branch of the armed services, and had somebody come up from each of those branches. They actually, at the end of the service, they had fireworks go off within their sanctuary.
In the sanctuary, oh yes. My word.
And had, you know, so one of these mega churches, had soldiers rappel down the wall. Yeah, it was pretty overblown.
Well, that makes this article that Agner wrote seem kind of tame. My word.
Yeah.
So, we need to show a little love to our underwriters right now. So, Peace and Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Pita Pit, locally owned and operated in downtown Chico at 240 Broadway, and they've been there since 2004. The Pita Pit features a variety of fresh Mediterranean, Greek, and American foods, including pita wraps, falafels, gyros, and deli favorites, all made to order. Pita Pit is open 7 days a week with catering and delivery available by calling 899-2847 and by Disability Action Center, dedicated to gaining social and economic justice for people with disabilities. DAC can be reached by calling 893-8527 and at actionctr.org. And again, this is Peace and Justice here on KZFR 90.1, People Powered Radio, and you are listening to the Awesome Authors Edition of the show with my second guest, Craig Watts, author of Bowing Towards Babylon, The Nationalistic Subversion of Christian Worship in America. And I want to remind our listeners that if you enjoy this program, you can now go to kzfr.org and tip this show. I think that's kind of like liking it on Facebook, but you can tip the show. Craig, as I'm pondering this whole subject of how nationalism has crept into our churches, I can't help but think of other faith traditions or maybe even other countries. Again, I'm not the most observant person in the world, but I cannot think of any time that I've ever walked into a Buddhist monastery or a mosque or a Baha'i meeting or anything like that and seen a flag. Is this unique? Are there other faith traditions that you know of that go to this lengths of nationalism?
I can't speak for all religious groups. I do know that flags show up in some synagogues, particularly Reformed synagogues.
Right.
But in terms of other faith traditions, I really have no idea.
Yeah.
I know that this is not something that is done in most nations.
Yeah.
In fact, people from other nations wonder what the flag's doing in the sanctuary in this country. We had a couple that came here a number of years ago, and she was raised in a big megachurch where a very prominent leader of the religious right was a minister. And that church sent her over to Eastern Europe as a missionary. And while she was there, she married a man who was a Baptist minister, born and raised in an Eastern European nation, came back, and when he went to worship with her, he was appalled.
Yeah.
Appalled. Things that she had never thought of before, never noticed before, just for him, they were just glaring. And they ended up coming to our church looking for someplace else to worship because he was so uncomfortable. And she then became aware of what was going on and confessed that often the worship there is more a patriotic rally than a genuine worship to the God of Saul.
Yeah. Well, which leads me to ask, why are we so unique? Why are we American Christians? So how did we get tied up into this?
Well, early on, those who came over here, fleeing persecution most often, thought that they would establish a nation that would honor God. They had the intention to form a genuine Christian community here. And even though very early on, certainly by the time the founding fathers began to work toward revolution and then the formation of this country, you know, that mindset was very present. It was not shared by the founding fathers, but nevertheless, very present. And ministers continued through the years pushing this idea that the United States was in some fashion a nation that had the special blessings of God, that it was, if not a chosen nation, an almost chosen nation. And so this linkage of the nation and God and God's work and the providential efforts of God for the betterment of the world has been present here pretty much from the beginning. Now, that's not to say that there aren't other nations that have seen themselves as particularly blessed and crucial to the good of the world. Certainly, that was true at different points in France. It was true in Russia. You know, we could go on down the list. But it has continued here in a way that it hasn't continued in the other nations.
Yeah. So how do we push back?
I think we just need to be ourselves, I mean, as church. The issue, and some people imagine it's because I'm anti-American or, you know, have no patriotism. In fact, I do have patriotism, but I think a healthy patriotism doesn't identify the nation with God.
Right.
I think we can recognize the beauty and the goodness without becoming uncritical and virtually idolatrous in our devotion to the nation. But when we come together in worship, we are coming together as a people who have been called by God, revealed in Jesus Christ. When we get together here, we come not as people who have you know, various identities that those identities themselves are to be focused on. I mean, so, you know, we can come here as people who are articulate and some who are not, those who are educated, those who are not, those who are differently abled, and those who have deficiencies in different ways. And we come together in that diversity because our unity is in Christ. And even though we might have a group of people who are all from one country, that's not the case in the church I serve, but nevertheless, in many churches it is, that's not who we are when we get together. We are getting together as a people of God called through Jesus Christ. And everything that we do in worship, every symbol that we present in worship, should underline that truth. And when we worship, we should be representing the Christian story, not any other story. The special days that we recognize should reinforce that story, not any other story. And in doing so, our character is being shaped. Our affections are being shaped. Our vision is being shaped. And when we add some other identity and some other story into that, it mars what should be taking place in worship and what should be taking place in our lives as worshipers. Because we're presenting a different sort of God than the God that we find presented by Jesus in the Gospels.
Sure, yeah. And in my own theology, in my own understanding, in my own preaching, I always try to emphasize that Jesus was continually challenging empire and showing the differences between the reign of God and the reign of Caesar. And,
right.
You know, we can apply that today to our cultural context as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, said no one can serve two masters.
Right.
But we have a lot of Christians who just don't believe that. Or they've so identified God with nation that they can't tell the difference and seem to think that the two are one.
Right, right. Well, Craig, I do appreciate you agreeing to be on the show today. I ask all of my guests this. Sometimes when we start talking about peace and social justice issues, when we start challenging some of our institutions and things, it kind of puts people into a foul mood sometimes. And when it's good, it causes us to spring into action, but then there are some times when we feel just kind of deflated. What's a good word today that you can offer for us, a word of encouragement?
Well, let me go back to worship.
Okay.
When we get together and we come to the table and we share communion together, those of us who are sharing it are not just those within that building or within that nation, but we are united with those throughout the world. And that oneness should spread so that it's not just with other Christians, but with all people. And through that, we have a foundation for peace.
Yeah. That's great. Well, your book can be found on, I saw it on Amazon. What are some other ways that we can get a hold of your book?
Well, I suppose you can get it from Barnes & Noble. You can order directly from the publisher, Cascade Books. If you want to contact me, I've got a few copies.
Great. Where can people find you? I've already mentioned the Red Letter Christian Network there and Facebook page, but where else can we find you and things that you write?
Well, you can Google me on Royal Palm Christian Church in Coral Springs, Florida, and contact me through the church. Other writings, if you just Google Craig M. Watts, some of my longer essays can be found there. Some of my longer essays can also be found on the Disciples Peace Fellowship website if you go to resources, theological and biblical resources.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, thank you, Craig. I appreciate you being on the show, and I appreciate you being a champion for peace and justice in all that you do.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I appreciate it.
All right. And you are listening to Peace and Justice here on KZFR 90.1. Let's take another song break. I know who we have this time. We have Elvis Costello.
Elvis Costello, Every Day I Write the Book. You gotta give writers credit. They have an awful lot of discipline that they can sit down and put their thoughts on. Well, Elvis Costello is saying his electric typewriter, so I hesitate to say paper because, you know, we use computers now. We use word processors. We use voice recognition software. But yeah, we are on Peace and Justice today talking about some awesome authors. And we've already spoken to Craig M. Watts, and before that, Robert Dolezal. And we've got one more coming up here pretty soon, but I've got to give some love to our community calendar.
90.1 KCFR presents in Chico the return of James McMurtry, one of America's most important singer-songwriters, back in Chico at the Chico Women's Club. James McMurtry, Friday, August 4th.
The wolves howl all night long. They won't stop and they won't go home. Beneath my window they run.
James McMurtry.
Far as you can point your hands, nothing but level land. Where'd you get that red dress?
James McMurtry in Chico.
Choctaw bingo every Friday night. It drinks his Johnny Walker at that Club 69. We're gonna strap them kids in, give them a little bit of Benadryl and a cherry coke. We're going to Oklahoma, gonna have us a time.
James McMurtry in Chico, Friday night, August 4th. It's a KZFR benefit. Chico Women's Club, doors at 6:30, show at 7:30. Tickets $25. You can get them at kzfr.org, Chico Paper Company, and Blazin' J's in Chico. Beer from Sierra Nevada, closed circuit TV feed, and speakers on the patio provided by BCAC TV. This is a dance concert at the Chico Women's Club. Limited seating available. First come, first serve. Doors at 6:30, show at 7:30. James McMurtry and his band, Friday, August 4th at the Chico Women's Club. More info online at kzfr.org. Tickets also available in Chico at Music Connection.
And this is FM 90.1 KZFR, Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And this is the Awesome Authors Edition of Peace and Justice. Our last interview today is also a pre-recorded interview with a good friend of mine, Shonda Jha, who has written several books, and she's here to talk about her newest one. And my third guest on Peace and Justice today is Shonda Jha, who is the director of the Oakland Peace Center. She is the author of Pre-Post-Racial America, Spiritual Stories from the Frontlines, and author of Room at the Table, Struggle for Unity and Equality in Disciples' History. She is a blogger on faith, social justice, and dating at ShondaJha.com. Podcast host of Hope from the Hood, a peaceful, the peaceful city
on the inspiring piecework of Oakland Peace Center Partners. She is a preacher, a speaker, a trainer, and facilitator. And one of the reasons I have you on the show today, Shonda, she is the author of Transforming Communities, How People Like You Are Healing Their Neighborhoods, which will be on sale in November, I believe.
That's right.
And although I noticed
October,
November. Oh, yeah. I noticed that you can pre-order it right now on Amazon. I imagine you can pre-order it in other places, too.
And through Chalice Press, the publisher. That's right.
Of course. Welcome, Shonda. Good to talk to you again.
I'm thrilled to be back. Thanks so much.
Okay. A question that I've been asking all my guests on this awesome author's edition of Peace and Justice is, where in the world did this book come from? Or I guess a better way to frame that is, what's this book about and what prompted you to write it?
So this is kind of a really good luck timing-wise kind of situation. The publisher at Chalice Press said, where do you want to be in 5 years? What book will help get you there?
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't, how will it launch your career? It was, what is it you're trying to create? Because I publish specifically through a publisher who identifies themselves as a faith-based publisher oriented towards creating a more inclusive world. So a very kind of progressive worldview. And they're really seeing publishing as their contribution to building the social justice movement, to building a better Christianity. And so the publisher said, you know, what is it you're trying to create? What book would help you create that? And for me, it was a pretty easy question to answer. And I'm really grateful that they asked that, because my previous book, Pre-Post-Racial America, I'm really glad I had the opportunity to write it, but it took a lot out of me. Just living in the questions about race 24/7 and constantly being in conversations about the ways in which the American structures of race do such harm to people of color and also to white people, took a toll. And the fact that that was all I was talking about in public arenas, it was really emotionally exhausting. And I think there's something to the idea that what we focus on is what we help create. And so I'm glad I did that book, because I also think it's important for us to acknowledge what is broken in the world around us, what is not functioning in the world around us, so that we can fix it instead of pretending everything's fine. But this book was a lot more fun because it was a chance to focus on regular people who are making a huge difference and how we can learn from them and incorporate their wisdom into our day-to-day lives.
Right. You know, I've got a confession to make to my listeners. I received a draft of your book yesterday, and it is, I would consider it a very inspiring book. Not that Pre-Post-Racial America wasn't,
right.
But you're right, there's a different tone to this, and it's great. I haven't had an opportunity to read it all thoroughly, just because, yeah, I got it yesterday, but I was able to read chapters that are not only of particular interest to me, but to our community here in Chico. The power of reorganizing assets, the power of listening, community conversations, the power of making things right, restorative justice models, the power of keeping it simple. Humans deserve housing. I mean, that's a big issue right now in Chico, is dealing with housing. Could you say something a little bit about that chapter, since it's very near and dear to the people here in Chico?
Absolutely. So I was really glad I got to write that particular chapter, because early on, before I got really involved in social justice work, I was introduced to the work of the Kensington Workers' Rights Union in Philadelphia, and they have a really distinct way of going about their work, which is, it was folks from a very poor neighborhood where homelessness was a real thing, where subpar conditions for housing was a very real thing. And this may not sound like anything exceptional, but they realized that the people who could best speak to how to address those issues was people who were poor.
Right.
And they got folks together who were living with lousy conditions, and in that time frame, it was a time where people kept saying, what are we going to do about welfare? What are we going to do about the problem of people on welfare? And they said, well, what if people who were on welfare were part of the conversation? We might come up with solutions that everybody likes. And so they started to realize that this conversation was being made much more complicated than it needed to be in a country where it turns out we have the resources to house everybody and that it would actually be cheaper to do so. What would happen if we just started with the premise of everybody deserves a place to live? Or if whether or not people deserve anything, it is entirely plausible that we can house everybody, right?
Right.
And now there are other essays in other parts of the book that talk about things like the tiny homes movement and different strategies that people are using to address homelessness. That particular group of people that I focused on in that chapter were more oriented around changing public policy. But there are also very tangible things we can do. In fact, around Oakland, we're involved in a lot of conversations with synagogues and mosques and churches who have a little bit of extra land, and getting them connected to nonprofit developers with a really strong track record of building housing for low-income folks, and helping them use the resources they have to make other people's lives better. So there are some actually very simple solutions out there to address the housing crisis.
Yeah.
And I think the important thing to remember is it's not always government officials who have the answers. It's not, some people would say it's rarely government officials who have the answers. It's very often people with the lived experience who have the wisdom to contribute to make our public policy better, and just to make the way we do community decision making better.
Yeah. We have a host here, Gilmero Mash, Bill. He hosts a show called Without a Roof, and that's a subject that's near and dear to his heart. And you know, the question of how do we mobilize people in the community while including the folks who are without a roof now? What do you see as the difficulty in that in your context?
The difficulty. So I was at a city council meeting here, in, down here in Oakland, about a year ago.
Brave woman.
And and we, the organization I work with, works with a lot of homeless and formerly homeless people, some of whom live in nonprofit developed affordable housing, and they see it as their job to help make sure other people have that same opportunity because it transformed their lives. And dozens of them came to the mic and shared their stories about, here's what it was like when I was sleeping on the sidewalk. Here's what my life's like now. I don't want anyone to have to go through that. Many of them are people who had jobs, who had housing. When they retired, they could no longer afford housing. Person after person shared their stories. And then somebody got to the mic and said, I'm a middle-class person who is struggling to stay in Oakland and nobody cares about me. And all of a sudden, the city council was listening. And her point was, they were actually trying to move money away from low-income folks towards the middle class. And so the council was really excited about this because they're much more excited about advocating for middle-class folks.
Right.
Now, don't get me wrong. I think we need all, right? We need teachers. We need firefighters to be able to still afford to live in our communities. And there are a lot of people who gave their whole lives, but they gave their lives as secretaries or as fast food workers or many of the low-income jobs that our cities, all of our cities, require in order to function. And so I think one of the challenges I see is even when we organize and mobilize and empower low-income, homeless and formerly homeless folks to bring their voice into the conversation, my observation has been legislators aren't really interested in hearing from them in the same ways they are from people who make up their tax base. Yeah. And that's one of the heartbreaking challenges. And so that's why we need to organize that much harder.
Right. Well, if you're just joining us, this is Peace and Justice on KZFR 90.1, People Powered Radio. And Peace and Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Yang Professional Chiropractic, offering chiropractic services at 2275 Myers Street in Oroville and 1835 North Beale Street, Suite B, in Marysville. Dr. Ma Yang offers Hmong translation and accepts insurance for car accidents, sports injuries, neck and back pain, along with leg and arm pain. And so to reach Dr. Yang, call 533-6400. And also by Tim Kemper of Stanford Mortgage. Tim is a proud supporter of KZFR, so to learn how Tim can help make your dreams come true, visit his new website, timkemperloans.com, or by calling 530-571-7723, MLO number 977542, an equal housing opportunity. And again, this is Peace and Justice in our Awesome Authors edition with author Shonda Jha. Of all the things that you have written and all of the things that you have on your bio here, the most important thing among those that I haven't mentioned yet is Shonda Jha is my friend, and I appreciate you so much, Shonda.
Do you mind if I throw one quick comment in?
Sure.
I was just thinking, I want to be really clear about the fact that I think an exciting opportunity for us, and I think this is part of why I wrote this book, is I was talking about how sometimes people listen, our elected officials listen to one group more than another.
Yeah.
What an exciting opportunity for us if we are united across those divides, across class differences, across racial ethnic differences, if we're showing up for each other.
Yeah.
And using our power to support each other. That builds up the kind of beloved community I want to be a part of. And so I was sharing kind of a challenge, and I couldn't help but feel like I wanted to share the opportunity side of that as well, because that's kind of what the book's about, is what can happen when we show up for each other and with each other.
Right. Well, these are all topics. All of the topics that I've mentioned in your chapter headings have been covered here on Peace and Justice by our rotating hosts.
Yes.
Here. But because, yes, I'm interested in how these issues intersect with faith, Chapter 9 caught my attention, and that is the power of rooted faith. And as you said at the beginning of this chapter, even though you wrote this book for all people, whether they see the world through the lens of faith or not,
yes,
as the daughter of a Hindu father and a Scottish Presbyterian mother, you just aren't going to skip that one over, right? And
that's right.
You know, and when you've got folks like Reverend William Barber, Bill Barber, and his,
yes,
work with Moral Mondays in the headlines, you know, not just on the sidelines,
yes,
but in the headlines, you cannot ignore the role of faith groups when you're talking about transforming communities. So tell me about this chapter.
No, and he's such a great illustration of faith-rooted organizing. I got to go to a prayer vigil rally, it's hard to tell the difference with the Moral Mondays folks, that they did just before they were going to the state Supreme Court in North Carolina.
Oh, that's the one where Bill was arrested?
This was about 2 years ago.
Oh, okay,
they were
this
going
was
to
a while
the,
ago.
Yeah, so they were going to the court about voter disenfranchisement. So I bet a lot of your listeners already know that there have been some really heartbreaking intentional efforts to roll back voter rights, particularly for Black and Latino voters, or immigrant voters. It's particularly impacting Latino immigrants, but and in North Carolina, particularly Black voters, in Texas, particularly Latino immigrants. And they were about to go to court to fight for... It's ridiculous, right, that in 2015 and in 2016 and in 2017, we're even having that conversation.
No kidding.
They had a prayer vigil, and there were Buddhists and Jews and Muslims. I was sitting right right behind a row of people from the Nation of Islam and right in front of a row of gay and lesbian Jewish folks from an activist organization there. And there was something about how deeply spiritual it was and how everybody who spoke was speaking from their distinct traditions. And it wasn't watering everything down to the lowest common denominator, but it was aspiring to what one of my colleagues refers to as the greatest common denominator. My colleague B.K. Woodson talks about how our work in faith-rooted organizing needs to be about building towards the greatest common denominator and acknowledging our distinctiveness across faiths and not apologizing for the fact that our faiths shape who we are and connecting with other people across those faith connections as part of our organizing work. I think part of why it matters, and I want to be really clear, I know that there's some really intense, aggressive, fierce faith-based organizing out there that can be really scary to people who have never done anything like that before. Faith-rooted organizing as a model kind of emerges out of the civil rights movement and out of Latin American liberation theology and out of Mahatma Gandhi's Satyagraha movement in India. And they're much more grounded in who we are in the midst of our work to affect change. So the fact that we don't have enemies in our work, we recognize even the people who are opposing our values as brothers and sisters. And I think that's important because it allows us to maintain the integrity of what I would call our souls. It allows us to maintain our integrity as human beings while we take on the powers that be, that we don't let them diminish us by making us hate them. And that was a really important part of the way Dr. King did his work. We tend to pay attention to the policy work he did, which was amazing, but it was how he was doing that work that was distinctive and very different from the Saul Alinsky model of organizing that dominated all sorts of organizing throughout the 20th century in this country. It was a different way of organizing because it was grounded in the best of who we are as spiritual beings and bringing that into the organizing work.
Okay. So, okay, here we are in Chico, and your context is Oakland. And Oakland is a sizable city in California. And again, you're a brave woman for going to city council meetings there in Oakland. City council meetings here in Chico tend to be on in a smaller scale, but sometimes we can pack that council chambers pretty well. And how is your interfaith community down there in Oakland? I mean, who is it comprised of? How does it operate? What's your assessment of the interfaith community down there?
You know, maybe it's you find what you're looking for, but I've been really touched by how deeply people bring their spirituality into their organizing work. And so a lot of the folks I know who show up for vigils and protests and rallies and show up in city council chambers are members of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship or East Bay Meditation Center. Or this afternoon I'm going to be going and praying with some of my indigenous brothers and sisters because we're recognizing that part of the indigenous rights movement includes the sweat lodge that some of the neighbors are protesting, even though the people who are running the sweat lodge are honoring every possible restriction they need to. And even though the Oakland Fire Department came out, inspected it, and said they were doing everything right, that our planning commission is kind of scared of the opposition they're getting and is slowing down the process of officially acknowledging that the sweat lodge is allowed to be there. And so for us to be showing up for each other's spiritual rights is actually part of the work we're doing. So it's been really kind of beautiful to watch rabbis showing up alongside. So one of the last times I got arrested was alongside a rabbi because they knew they needed a female religious leader and a male religious leader to get arrested along with the workers to make sure that they got treated well if we ended up getting sent to jail. And so there's something about people bringing, and he prayed us through the process of shutting down the street and praying us through getting taken away by the police. And there's something kind of beautiful about the ways that we're showing up for each other in that work. And it's a very diverse group. And I think that that's very much true of you and Chico as well.
Yeah, we've got quite a diverse group here in Chico. You know, I've lived in communities where the Interfaith Council is a bunch of Protestants, a token Catholic, and maybe a token Jewish rabbi.
Right.
But you know, here in Chico, just executive committee, the officers, we represent two. I don't know whether you'd call them Eastern, but we have somebody from the Spiritual Life Center. Our president is Baha'i, and we have a Sufi as our treasurer. I'm the only male Protestant on the whole lot.
Wow.
There, so it's cool. We sometimes kind of struggle with our identity as far as what is our purpose here. And I know that we like to would like to get involved in some more community action and things like that. But with such a diverse group, sometimes it's difficult to find an issue that we can all get behind.
Yeah.
So how does that work with y'all down in Oakland there?
You know, it's interesting because I think that there is an Interfaith Council of Alameda County that's just forming. There's a really strong Interfaith Council of Contra Costa County. And with Contra Costa, they found that the best role for that Interfaith Council was to focus primarily on interreligious dialogue. And they created a separate organization to do the activism and advocacy work, which allowed the folks who that was not yet in their comfort zone,
right,
the opportunity to stay out of it. And in Alameda County, or in Oakland specifically, most of the interfaith organizing we do is by coalitions that come together and dissolve so that people don't have to be part of an institutional organization to engage in a particular campaign. And for some people, if it violates their religious principles to be involved in any campaign work, that way they don't have to be. So it's a little bit more informal. We've got a network of folks who stay engaged with each other around the political campaign work. Interestingly enough, and I don't know whether this is controversial or not, a lot of that network emerged most strongly around Occupy Oakland, because there was an interfaith tent there that was very intentionally interfaith.
Right.
And that created some of the structure that we continue to function out of today.
Yeah.
That's certainly how I got to know a couple of the folks there, even though I wasn't super active in Occupy. The interfaith tent was a place I could plug in when the other stuff going on with Occupy didn't always resonate with me completely.
Right. Oh my gosh, Shonda.
Work as well.
Yeah. Well, this happens every time that I'm interviewing you, is time flies and I look at my clock and say, oh my gosh, I got to wind this down. It is so good talking to you.
I love getting the chance to talk, Jesse.
All right. Well, Shonda, thank you once again for being on the show. And you're listening to 90.1 KCFR, People Powered Radio, right here in Chico. We're listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And this has been the Awesome Authors Edition of Peace and Justice. Next month, I'm not sure what I'm going to call the show that I'm hosting next month. I think I want to call it the Donnie and Marie edition. And I only say that because we're going to have a variety. At least so far, I've got quite a variety of people lined up. I've got Tom Kellum and anybody else from Stonewall Alliance that might be accompanying him to the studio. He's going to be one of my guests, and he's going to be talking about Chico Pride. And this is on the day before the actual event in the plaza on August 19th. So that'll be nice having Tom here to give us a little history about Chico Pride and maybe prompt some of our listeners to come down and join the folks in celebrating Pride. And then I've also got Anna Moore from a group that I've only recently heard of and been in contact with, and that is Mobilize Chico. Mobilize Chico is a California-based group that is dedicated to the defense of human rights and human dignity and to the preservation of democratic values locally, regionally, and nationally through political engagement, direct action, and community collaboration. In fact, they've got some stuff going on this weekend. On Sunday, at the Chico Peace and Justice Center from 12:15 to 12:45, they're going to be having a meeting. And at that meeting, they'll be briefly celebrating the Randall Stone. He's going to be bringing they're going to be bringing Randall Stone in, who serves on the Chico City Council. And he's going to be talking about what's some of the things that are coming up on the city council agenda. And they're going to start their local media writing campaign. And they're also going to connect gamer resources and be the darn good people that they are. So, again, that's next month on Peace and Justice. The show will be on August 18th that I'll be hosting Tom Kellum from Stonewall Alliance and Anna Moore from Mobilize Chico. So we're going to end the show today with a song by Alanis Morissette called Incomplete. I know we've been doing some songs that relate to writing. I think writing doesn't just get put on paper. Good writing can happen in song, too. And this song by Alanis Morissette is particularly intriguing to me because she talks about her life and some of the things that she wished she may have done during her lifetime. And so the song is called Incomplete. Till next time, do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly.
One day I'll find relief. I'll be arriving, and I'll be a friend to my friends who know how to be friends. One day I'll be at peace. I'll be enlightened, and I'll be married with children and maybe adopt. One day I will be healed. I will gather my wounds, forge the end of tragic comedy. I have been running so sweaty my whole life, urgent for a finish line. And I have been missing the rapture this whole time of being forever incomplete. One day my mind will retreat, and I'll know God, and I'll be constantly one with her, night, dusk, and day. One day I'll be secure, like the women I see on their 30th anniversaries. I have been running so sweaty my whole life, urgent for a finish line. And I have been missing the rapture this whole time of being forever incomplete, ever unfolding, never done. One day I will speak free. freely. I'll be less afraid and measured outside of my poems and lyrics and art. One day I will be faith-filled. I'll be trusting and spacious, authentic and grounded and home. I have been running so sweet.